Welcome to Losing My Religion. It's been a while, 3 years since my last podcast in this series. And since then, not only has my first memoir been published, but my second memoir has been published. The first one was In My Gut, I Don't Believe. And the second is Saved by a Woman. And they're both available on Amazon as Kindle, paperback and hardback. And the first one, In My Gut, I Don't Believe, is also available in Audible. Both are in the memoir series Losing Religion, Finding Myself. And since you've last heard from me on this podcast, I've also started a Substack called Joe the Human. So if you want to Google Joe the Human Substack, you will find everything you need to know about me. It will provide links to YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and everything. On the 3rd of this month, March 2024, the 3rd of March, I was invited by Jill Bell, who is the convener of the Northwest Humanists in Ireland. I was invited as our guest speaker. And Jill very kindly interviewed me, and I read from both of my memoirs. Both books I wrote primarily for myself to try to understand how somebody who set out in life to become a priest, you know, who believed enough and who thought that was the meaning of life, to the extent of wanting to be a priest, how I now no longer believe in God or in an afterlife, and I'm happier than I ever was, and I'm more full of joy, and my life is more integrated. So I wanted to understand myself. The old Socratic dictum is important to me. Know thyself, and the unexamined life is not worth living. So after the publication of the first book, lots of people asked me, and reviewers said, well, what about a second book? Like, what happened to Joe Armstrong after he left, having spent 9 years studying to be a priest? So at the tender age of 27, off I went. What happened next? So the next book, Saved by Woman, is about the 6 years of my life after I left the Marist Fathers. In fact, technically, I didn't leave them. I went out on leave of absence. I had two years leave of absence. And in fact, I only needed one. So the first part of the second memoir, the first item that I have to deal with is to decide whether to definitively burn my bridges with the Marists or to leave open the possibility of return. And then after that, it's about becoming more comfortable in my sexuality and finding a life partner, falling in love, deciding what I was going to work at. I became a teacher. But I never really wanted to be a teacher, but it was better than serving cappuccinos and washing dishes and being abused by members of the general public. So the second memoir, still exploring that life theme of the shift from religion, losing religion and finding myself. So Jill Bell invited me to Sligo, and I today uploaded the video of that public event to one of my YouTube channels. I have two YouTube channels. One is for humanist ceremonies, although I'm doing very, very, very few of them at the moment by choice, because I'm concentrating on writing, which is what I've always wanted to do all of my life. So I do have a second channel called Losing My Religion. And if you're on either of those channels on YouTube, if you scroll down the page, you'll sort of get a link to the other channel. But in error, I uploaded the full 90-minute event in Sligo, which is a very interesting one, and I think you'll enjoy it. I uploaded that to the Humanist Ceremonies one, the Humanist Weddings one. And then I split that in two, into two videos of about 40 minutes each. And I also uploaded both of those to my Humanist Ceremonies channel. In any event, they are available on YouTube. And these few words, which I'm stumbling over right now, it will also become a podcast. Happy to see that my Losing My Religion podcast has more than 3,500 downloads. So even though I've been quiet over the last while in terms of that podcast, this podcast, I should say, because I'm resuming it now, clearly it has attracted some attention. And so thank you, and I hope you have found it interesting. I would encourage you to subscribe for free to my Substack, because the Substack I write generally every Friday. And so there's a post there every Friday. If you sign up to it for free, it will arrive automatically in your inbox. And if you have the Substack app, it will arrive automatically in your app once you've subscribed to it. You can, of course, also contribute to your coffers. But honestly, for me, and I thank you, those of you who do that, but there's utterly and absolutely no obligation to do that. The joy for a writer is to be read or to be listened to. So that's what's really important to me. So please do consider signing up. And when you sign up, you will see subscribe, and you might think subscribe means paying. It doesn't. You can subscribe for free, and almost everybody does. So thank you, those who have subscribed for free. Thank you also, those of you who have subscribed with a financial contribution. So what follows is the first half of the event in Sligo. And I only got the video very recently, and I rather liked it. So I have listened back, as I say, I uploaded the whole thing to my YouTube channels. In fact, to my Humanist Ceremonies one, Humanist Weddings one. So if you go to my Substack, Joe the Human Substack, if you just Google Joe, J-O-E, the, T-H-E, Human, H-U-M-A-N, not Humanist, Human, H-U-M-A-N, Joe the Human Substack, S-U-B-S-T-A-C-K, you will find it, and do please subscribe. And there you will also find links on the very first page. Just scroll down the page on the right hand side, you will find links to my two YouTube channels. And so you will actually be able to see the video of the event in Sligo if you so wish. Or you can just listen to this podcast of the first half of it. I've also got the second half of it on YouTube, and I will ASAP do a second podcast with the second half. So that's enough talking. I'm now going to hand over to Jill Bell, who is the convener of the Northwest Humanists, who was chairing the event. Enjoy.
Good afternoon and welcome, everybody. I'm delighted to welcome Joe Armstrong. So he's got so many credits to his name. I'm just going to read from his book about him. He spent 9 years studying for the Roman Catholic priesthood with the Marist Fathers in Dublin in the 80s. He taught English and religious education in London for 5 years. He's a writer, podcaster, and humanist celebrant. His RTÉ Radio 1 documentary, From Belief to Unbelief, was shortlisted for New York Festival's World's Best Radio Awards. A multi-award-winning public speaker, aren't we lucky to have him? He is author of several books and was a weekly columnist with the Irish Times for 7 years. He's married with 2 adult children, and he lives in Ireland. So the theme for today we're going to talk about is losing religion and finding myself. And we're going to start with extracts maybe from your first book. But before you start, I just want to say that I was really struck by your raw honesty and openness in writing this and sharing in your book about your faith, your doubt, your sexuality, your struggle with celibacy. And so when I had read this book, I was just saying to Joe over lunch earlier, it's like when you're watching a series on Netflix or something, and you want to see the next episode as quickly as possible. So I can't wait, actually, to read the second book after reading the first book. So where should we start?
Well, I think we should start by reading from the first book.
Okay.
I asked Jill to choose the passages that she'd like me to read, and she did. And so the first one, which she suggested, This was a letter that I wrote. I kept journals all of my life, right? Which is why I was able to write my memoirs, because your memory is a very unreliable source. But because I'd written contemporaneous journals right through my life, I had it all there, how I was thinking, how I was feeling. And I had letters, I always kept letters. So this was a letter that I sent my Uncle John, and my Uncle John was a priest, a Catholic priest. And I sent this letter to him in 1979, when I was all of 17. It's incredibly embarrassing. And when I was just, Jill referred to the RT documentary, and when the production supervisor saw this letter, she said, "Oh, we have to use that." And I said, "No, we can't, it's too embarrassing." But that's all right. Hello. You're welcome. So it's very embarrassing, but it shows, and this is sort of my intention in writing the book, was just to show how I was thinking. Dear Uncle John, 17-year-old Joseph, right? Dear Uncle John, I would like this to be the first letter you receive from Ireland, because he lived in South Africa, after the postal strike. Anybody here old enough to remember the postal strike in 1979? Yeah. Went on for months. The first thing I want to tell you, and it's the only thing that's really important, is that I joined the charismatic prayer meeting. A charismatic prayer meeting. And really, Uncle John, it's great. Christ's love is flowing more and more in Ireland through the charismatic renewal. Pockets of Christians are opening up all over the city. Only last night, we heard news of a new prayer meeting in Sean McDermott Street. You can hear I'm a dope, I'm from Dublin. Right? Yeah, Sean McDermott Street. Only weeks ago, another in the Mater Hospital. This, along with the many little known parish prayer meetings like Edenmore and Dunnecarney. I'm from Dunnecarney, north side of Dublin. And the bigger ones like the airport and Eustace Street. Only in the last few months have we seen the increased numbers of Dove badges. If you're in the charismatic renewal at that time, you went around a little dove for the Holy Spirit.
That's right. Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do.
Did you have one?
I know.
You were lucky. Now I've lost where I was. Oh yeah, dove badges, which are seen worn by all sorts of people. Mass that was boring and dead is now joyful and alive. The risen Christ is seen so often. Well, Jesus, I don't know where I saw him, but that's what I wrote. 4 weeks ago, I joined our parish meeting, and I've been going for months to the one in our school. We have one charismatic priest in our parish, but only last night, another priest turned up from our parish. I pray that he will get over his initial discomfort. Please, Uncle John, pray for him too. And for all others that are starting to know, not about Christ, but to actually know him. Please, if you have a minute, pray for me too. At present, in our parish, we are about 100. In Dundalk, it started at 50. Now, it's 1,000. God, I was so excited, wasn't I? Last weekend, there was a major gathering at Knock. Not too far from here, really. Many witnessed to healing. One, who was so far gone, physically. Far gone. Is that a diagnosable condition? He was so far gone, physically, had returned an invalid to Ireland to die, and he witnessed a healing. Another was cured of multiple sclerosis. I'd like to see the evidence, but there you go. Our own charismatic priest tells of a man cured of a 20-year-old ankle disorder. I'd say he went to the physio, but anyway. And mental healing spreads like fire. To those of us within the renewal, it's back to the excitement lost and forgotten for centuries. The excitement of the realisation of the risen Christ, whatever happened to the church between then and now. You know, it feels like we're just continuing another chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, as if there's been no time lapse at all. The fruits of the Spirit are flowing. God is alive. Jesus is Lord. Yeah. Isn't it wonderful? Somebody walked in here now today, they think this is a prayer meeting. Instead of a humanist gathering, non-believers. Jesus, Lord, isn't it wonderful? Oh, sure, I always knew with my head. How did I always know with my head? That Jesus was God. How did you always know that, Joe? But anyway, that's for real.
But now it's with my heart. I hope I'm not being hypocritical. The enthusiasm, the excitement seems, wait for it, false.
Bloody dead.
It's so long been absent. Let's praise God. Night and day.
You walked in here now, they'd be saying, yes, they're very religious in there.
God bless you. Praise God and write soon. I wrote that when I was 17. That was me.
So that demonstrated your religious fervour at the
time.
It did. And could you tell us what Uncle John meant to you? Why were you writing that letter to him?
He was a brother of my father. And he was physically huge. And he meant a lot to me. I just, you know, you click it with somebody. So I was very fond of him and he was very fond of me. He had spent 11, I spent 9 years in a seminary. He spent 11 years in a sanatorium because he had TB. And the story of his faith made a huge impact on my life. Because at that time, with TB, once you got it, that was it. There was no cure. So he was basically left in hospital for 11 years. I think he got out once during all of that time. But despite that, he constantly prayed, because he was a religious man. This is Ireland of... he was born, I think, in 19... probably around about 1919 or even earlier. So, you know, very Catholic Ireland. And his constant prayer was, Lord, make me your priest. And like, he's lying there in a bed with TB and he's not going anywhere. He's never going to be a priest. But anyway, then science came along and they came up with medical solutions to TB. So he had an operation which he had a lung removed and most of the other lung. So for the rest of his life, he'd very little. He was hardly able to breathe. And my memory of him was when he'd come to us, to visit us, he'd stand at the door at night time and he'd be standing at the door and he'd go, oh, I can't. When he's standing at the door and he's going, and be taking these huge big breaths in, just trying to recharge his lungs, you know. So his story seemed to me to be proof of faith of God, because he got better. His prayer was, Lord, make me your priest. And then he had this operation and it didn't cure him, but it meant he could leave the sanatorium. And he wrote this letter to Archbishop McCann in South Africa, kind of, I want to become a priest. And Archbishop McCann in South Africa wrote back and he said, report to the Beda College in Rome, which he did. So he got out of the sanatorium, headed to Rome, studied for the priesthood, and my parents became engaged at his ordination.
Oh.
So that's all my good time.
Yes. Yeah. So what attracted you to train as a priest, and in particular, to go into a, did you say Marist or Marist?
Marist.
Marist, seminary.
They're called Marist because they're a French order. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, the Jesuits were the Society of Jesus. And the Marists were the Society of Mary. So in French, Marie is Marie. Mm-hmm. So they pair Marie, and la Société de Marie. So Marist. So I like, in my mid to late teens, the only thing I wanted to be was to be a priest. I had no interest in doing anything else. I did a pretty good intercert, and then I literally sabotaged my leaving cert so that I wouldn't be, quote unquote, tempted not to be a priest. So I kind of manipulated my own life to make sure I would become a priest. You know, crazy, crazy thinking. It just seemed to me to be the most important thing. Like, what's the meaning of life? Why are we here? I'm not motivated by money and prestige, fame. None of those things interest me. I could never figure out why people would spend their Sunday afternoon playing golf. I thought, why would you want to be doing that? Do you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But priesthood, it's like, and the idea, you know, as a kid, I watched people queue. And when I was a kid, you'd have everybody went to confession. Like, everybody went to confession. Mm-hmm. And on a Saturday night, you know, the night before Sunday Mass, there'd be queues of people. You go down to confession club. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I was in Dunnecarney Parish, which is huge church, and mass to be 7 or 8 masses on a Sunday, packed, absolutely packed. The same churches now are as long as nobody in them. So at that time, like I thought, well, the priest is in the confessional. All these people are coming to him, and he seems to know it all, and he seems to have a wise word for them all, or a comforting word for them all, or he can forgive them his sins. It just seemed to me, why wouldn't you want to be a priest? You know. Plus, then I went to Charismatic Renewal. So all of my background was, my mother was very religious, crazily religious. Although after that letter, you're thinking I was crazily religious too. So I had 2 cousins who were studying for the priesthood. It was just a huge influence. And it was Ireland. I was born in 1962. So it was a big thing in Ireland to be a priest. Priest, doctor, teacher, that was sort of it. And I said, I'll go for the best of them all. I'll be a priest. And then the Marists, I had heard that the Marist Seminary was, that there was a lot of stuff happening there. So that kind of excitement.
What kind of stuff?
Well, there were loads of students studying for the priesthood. So some of the seminaries were pretty dry and, you know, and some of them didn't have that many seminarians. But it just sounded like that was a happening kind of place because there were loads of people. And they seemed to be clued into the Charismatic Renewal, which I thought was the future for the church. So it seemed exciting. And I felt that's the place to go. And then this priest called Larry Duffy had a huge influence on my life. He was a charismatic priest, and I kind of thought he was just like somebody who walked straight out of the Bible. He was so impressive. And I thought, so he's just like Jeremiah, you know. God is talking directly to Larry Duffy. Yeah. That's what I thought, you know. We used to call him the laser beam. He was a brilliant preacher. And so I'm not going to read it now because it's going to take forever. But the passage I might have read out, at the end of it, he's telling me, you know, he's praying over me because I've told him I want to be a priest, and he's praying over me and he's saying, you know, many souls will be saved by your ministry. And this is like, in my mind, the guy who is a direct line to God telling me that many souls will be saved by my ministry. Away I go.
So we'll come to that passage in a minute, but if you write very early on in your time in Milltown, you write about your need for intimacy and your struggle with your celibacy and your doubts. But it seems that from a very early time you were considering about whether to carry on or to leave. But each time you decided to leave, you got persuaded to stay.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, that became, well, so the intimacy thing, you know, so the Marists, all Catholic priests aren't married. So there's secular priests and then there's religious priests. But if you're a member of a religious order, you also have a vow of celibacy. You don't just promise to your bishop that you won't get married.
Yeah.
You have a vow of celibacy. And I was kind of in the Marists when I got a shock, because like at the time people were talking that maybe in the near future, married priests would be allowed. So that sounded pretty cool to me. And I remember sitting at this lecture one day and the priest was talking to us about celibacy within the Marists. And he said, you know, even if tomorrow the Pope said the priests could get married, we couldn't get married because we have a vow of celibacy. And I'm kind of going, what? He never told me that before I joined the Marists. I was horrified, you know, because I thought, oh, celibacy was like a necessary, as I understood it, part of the package. You couldn't be a priest without being celibate. But maybe in the near future we could get married. And so that was a shocker. And by then I was already in, I was a novice, or I was first professed or something like that.
So would you like to read that next passage?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the second area, do you mean the one about when I decided to leave?
It's on 60.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, yes. Yeah. Okay, so 5 years in, right, 5 years in, I've struggled with this. And, it's so hard to choose to leave. But I struggled and struggled and struggled and struggled and struggled. And eventually I decided, right, that's it, I'm gone. So but this, it took 5 years. Slow learner, penny takes a long time to drop, right? So 5 years in, so this is kind of a key thing. So I'm going to read this one. So this is episode 60. My decision when it came on the 15th of December 1985, so now 23, in the middle of the night, a sleepless night, was definitive. As a boy of 23, I deemed it the loneliest decision of my life. After months of heightened anguish and discussions with the superior, my spiritual director, confessor, confers, and friends at UCD, attuned to myself, I weighed the evidence and I made my solitary choice, surging up from my gut. I tried to imagine God loving me into being in my mother's womb, loving me for who I am, not for what I did. I had learned that true love is one's presence with another person rather than doing things for them. I needed to appreciate myself for who I was, not for what I did. As love can't be won, why was I in a seminary? If life wasn't about helping the needy, if those who did that might be motivated out of their selfish need to be needed, it changed everything. And there were no brownie points for sacrifice. The paradigm I'd grown up with of self-sacrificial love needed radical revision. I couldn't think of anyone who was a priest or religious for other than delusional or selfish motives. I've seen enough of religious life to opine in my journal, scratch beneath the thin veneer of community life, and you will find the alienation of each individual within it. This is clearly 5 years on. I wouldn't have written that before I joined. At college, I warmed to Verena, girl at UCD, anytime I was near her. I wanted to kiss her when she touched me, hugged me, or came up close to me. Whenever we parted after a few minutes together, loneliness pained me. It was around this time that my history lecturer, Dr. Michael Richter at UCD, urged me to take my chance in the world. Take my chance in the world. Here was a caring, intelligent, authoritative adult suggesting an altogether different, responsible choice than the one presented to me in the seminary as the best one. Commit to yourself, he said to me. It is you who is important. Make yourself your priority. The first time I ever heard an adult say that to me. I dreamt of leaving the Marists. When I woke up, I could see myself going. Next night, I had another dream in which I journaled, I'm running down a lane, heading home. I mused, quote from the journal, God is not a vindictive God. He won't insist that I become a priest to be happy. He won't make me miserable outside if I choose to leave. It's an idea put into my head as a child. Later that day, there was a festive Christmas atmosphere in Grafton Street. Sipping coffee, I waited for my mother and sister in the packed Paris Court townhouse centre. A pianist began to play, and the music soothed me, lifting my mood. Then the full-voiced choir of the Glasnevin Musical Society blasted out, joy to the world, joy to the world, da, 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 da. And my angst had dissipated by the time my mother and sister arrived. I even managed to tolerate my mother's obsessive talking. I asked her to inquire about getting a grant from Guinness's, because my dad worked in Guinness's, or had worked in Guinness's before he died, for a master's degree. If she interpreted this request as she might, she didn't show it. During reconciliation service that night, I went to confession out of habit. I didn't feel contrite for my sins, quote unquote, and I couldn't have cared less if I hadn't received absolution. The sacrament had become an empty ritual. I sat in the chapel and I imagined telling my confrères. I owed it to them. Then I thought I might write something in their honour. Maybe this is it. I loved the place. It had been my home. I loved these men, well, most of them. I wondered how I would go. Would I be driven home in a house car, or would my sister collect me? I no longer needed to be a priest. I had to realise that I was loved and lovable. It was a breakthrough. I journaled, I don't have to be here to be happy. It's a choice, not a necessity. That night I couldn't sleep. My mother was inquiring about a grant for a master's degree. My university fees were paid. I had a medical card. Hopefully the Marists would give me some money I needed to get down to study. My life's future shape would depend on it. The tears came like a river, bucketing, just getting emotional reading this, bucketing down my face, unknotting my stomach. As I passed through that threshold, knowing I had to leave, I could do no other. Still the tears came. I was heaving now, terrified and relieved at the death of my dream for the priesthood and stepping into the unknown. I had decided, and I needed to tell someone. As my director, Father Dennis Green, was away, I knocked on the superior's door in the middle of the night, but his bedroom was on the far side of his office. He was asleep and he could not hear me. So that's a huge moment, obviously, in my life and in the book. Question to the audience. 5 years in, did I leave? No. So despite that profound moment of personal realization that I had to leave, I didn't.
Because?
Because about 2 weeks later, on the 30th of December, a good friend who had joined and left a convent called to see me. We had what I regarded in my journal as a most significant conversation about vocation, happiness, God's will, self-will, and my proposed leaving. I told her I was not a very good marist. And if you read the book, you know why. Given I had imagined at times that she and I could have a future together, I was surprised that she said that to leave involved less courage than to stay. I also met another girl I knew. She suggested I wasn't missing out on all that much by being in the Marists. None of the girls in her rented accommodation was going with anybody. It's yourself that counts, she said. A relationship is only possible when you are at peace with yourself. On New Year's Eve, this is 2 weeks after I decided to leave, I journaled. To stay involves daily effort, suffering, sin, dissatisfaction, crises, some difficult relationships and community, daily toil. To leave implies a supposed freedom, which is not so, material and sexual gratification, which fails to satisfy. Intellectual freewheeling. You lot are intellectual freewheelers. Which is untrue, and irresolute will. We are only given one vocation in life. A gap exists between my will and what I must admit I deep down believe to be God's will for me. Cringe. One answer is to cease to believe in my vocation. The other is to work humbly with my questions, doubts, disbeliefs, sins, trying to confirm conform my will to God's. My life is at breakdown. I must reconstruct it. A benefit of the crisis, I journaled, was I am now learning to reveal my needs to others. My week at home was a disaster. Things were never worse with my mother. She was a difficult woman. I journaled on the 3rd of January. Escaping early to Milltown, I found Tony Ward, who was a priest. He had handwritten Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken, for me. So, encouraging me to take the road less travelled by. My Uncle Jack, a stranger to subtlety and a devout Catholic, had posted me John Greenleaf Whittier's poem, Don't Quit. But I knew that on that crucial night in mid-December, I journaled, I simply did not believe in my vocation. I hadn't got one. That was the whole self-realization. The temptation to just slip back into daily living is very present. But at what cost? My confessor, the guy you make confession to, joined the fray. He said, it's a wrong decision to leave. I believe you have a vocation. And the very least you should do is to put it out of your head until you finish your BA this summer. By the 7th of January, I deemed my self-realization of mid-December a mistake. And what I haven't read out, because it sort of happened between the two extracts, is my spiritual director, whom I loved, Dennis Green, a lovely guy, but he totally what's the word? I know somebody who's read this has said that he betrayed me. I don't know if I would use that word, but when I told him that night, or whenever he came back from wherever he was, that I had decided to leave, at first he said, well, look, you've wrestled with this for long and hard, and, you know, I respect your decision. And I'm thinking, yes, this is much easier than I thought it was going to be. And then he went off and he talked to the superior, and he was gone a long time. And when he came back, he had totally changed his tune. And it was, wait another month, and, you know, this is the Society of Mary, the Mary's Fathers, they're a work of God. You can't just be...
go on another retreat.
Yeah, all that. And I remember thinking at the time, how can you say that? You've clearly got that from the superior. Because his authentic reaction was totally different. And then he comes back, and then right up to Christmas, he was... the Society of Mary is a work of God, and I was just getting all of this stuff on me, and I wasn't strong enough 5 years in, age 23, to resist it. So, you know, the girl had been in the convent and all of that, and I changed my mind. I couldn't believe it. I changed my mind, and I wasn't strong. But when I finally left, which was after 9 years, the nice thing is that I was then strong enough to resist all of that stuff. So I didn't care by then if the Pope himself had come in and knelt down in front of me and said, Joe, don't go. I would have said, get a life, I'm going.
So how do you think you went from having such a strong vocation to, first of all, deciding not to become a priest and then coming to not believe in God even?
Big jump.
It's a big jump. The kernel of it was the experience of In My Gut, which is where I got the title. Do you want me to read that out?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is kind of the climax of the book. 9 years, so 4 years after I decided to leave and been persuaded to stay. Obviously the wrong decision. So I've been called a diaconate. So you were made a deacon before you made a priest, and I've been called a diaconate. I got a date for the diaconate and all that kind of stuff. And I've got the collie wobbles, and I'm thinking there's something wrong. I don't feel comfortable about this, all of that kind of stuff. So eventually I say, look, I want to do counselling. So I ask, can I see a counsellor? So this is on the outside of the Marists. And it was a woman. So usually I'm, you know, a priest being directed by a priest. But this is a woman. She's not a Marist. She's not invested in me becoming a priest or a Marist priest. And so I went to her, and she was brilliant. I had so many insights. 20 sessions I had with her. Anyway, so that's just the context. So I'm seeing this psychologist. And to this day, I don't know her name. So in the book, I call her Ms. D, because I think her name began with a D, but I don't know what her name was. Crazy. There we go. I went out with my sister. This is 1989, 9 years in. And this is April of 1989, and I would leave in June. I went out with my sister for a drink on the night of Friday the 28th of April 1989, happy to have acted on my decision not to attend the weekend for senior Marist students. We met a friend of mine from UCD, a lovely, fine-looking fellow. He joined us upon my invitation. After drinks, we went to a nightclub. Linda, a friend of my sister, said to me, don't be a priest, be a waste. And next day I journaled, was in fine form, this day just ended. I studied and felt good about myself, appreciating that we become ourselves by acting on our decisions. The following day I skipped Sunday Mass. Yee-hoo! Do you know what? I was 27. First time in my life I was skipping Mass. Do you know? And when you're studying with priesthood, it's a huge thing to skip Sunday Mass. My second time to do so. I went for a cycle instead and enjoyed it.
There you go.
After a luxurious hot bath, I went with my friends Tom and Brendan to a Maura O'Connell concert at the Olympia. She was magnificent. Remember Maura O'Connell? Is she still around? She's brilliant. I loved her. The audience singing along with gusto. Here was life being lived to the full. A vibrant alternative universe to my preoccupation with religious concepts and sacrifice. On the 1st of May, I absented myself from Mass and morning prayer. I was getting really bad. I was depressed, though, and did little to study. I rang home to talk to my sister, but my mother answered. She spoke about a guy who pulled out just before diaconate, as if oblivious to my situation. My journal records my reaction as rage, but doesn't record if I let it show. At Spiritual Direction on the 2nd of May, I discussed avoiding Mass, my critical view of papal teachings, and my rejection of Catholic dogmas like the Immaculate Conception of Mary, a theological contrivance so that Jesus, supposedly divine, could be born of a woman unstained by original sin. I also found fundamental doubts about the sacramental and clerical systems of the Church. I also had fundamental doubts. She wondered if next time I might be closer to a decision. I journaled, opting for what's safe isn't working so well. I feel I'm turned inside out. Now, when I wrote that down, I feel I'm turned inside out, I thought that was a really painful thing, you know, if you're turned inside out. At first, the image spoke of my inner anguish and pain, but then I saw it as a powerful metaphor for my nascent self, my emerging self. Emerging from within, I was growing in personal integrity, becoming my authentic self, more comfortable in my skin. Next day, the 3rd of May, I had another liberating image of walking through glass unscathed, a breakthrough and a breakout. I felt it physically through my body, releasing tension from my gut. My self-imposed religious restrictions fell away, yielding shard by shard. I stepped through, crossing the boundary of my self-confinement, discovering the glass was a mirage. That sensation encapsulated my liberation, shattering the man-made boundaries of religion and of my mind. I was crossing a threshold, discarding a mask and a shell, stepping into personal freedom. I went to the careers office in UCD and explored becoming a writer, journalism, editing and publishing. I couldn't sleep that night due to existential questions cascading through my mind. All options remained open, doing the All Hallows course next year, choosing leave of absence, retaining my identity as a Marist, financial security should I need it, and the option of returning to the Marists, doing the higher diploma in education so I would be trained to teach as a security for me and not a waste of time, should I stay in the Marists, looking for a job in publishing in Ireland or London, or temporary employment with an eye to journalism. During counselling with Ms. D, but for my journal, it's not clear to me which session it was. It might have happened earlier or later in my process. She pushed me to decide the fundamental choice that faced me. Do you believe you have a vocation? She asked. I could still read both interpretations of my life. I don't know, I said. Get out of your head. What does your gut say? She asked. My gut. After all these years, was I to wager my life on my gut? Discarding other people's opinions, and the priest who told me you have a vocation, and ignoring my previous decisions to stay, and any theological argument, decide solely on my gut? She asked, in this moment, right now, in this moment, what does your gut say? The consequences for me couldn't have been starker. My vocation, identity, work, financial security, my past, present and unknown future, all to be determined by my gut. I became aware of my belly and my vital organs churning within. I don't know, I cried in despair. I know it's hard, but try. What does your gut say? I don't know. Right now, she persisted. The clock ticked, and out of the silence, I answered, no. I whispered from my gut. To be clear, what are you saying? In my gut, I don't believe. And it was the moment that changed my life. My Berlin Wall between head and gut was breached. And I know you're a woman who believes deeply in the gut.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, because some of you may know that my work as a biodynamic therapist, we understand the importance of the gut and the brain, the gut-brain access, and the fact that the messages come, it's a two-way channel. Yeah. So you can get messages from the gut to the brain as well as from the brain to the gut. And in fact, if you realise that, I think it's 90% of the serotonin in your body is produced in the gut, the lining of the gut.
And what does the serotonin do?
It's a feel good factor. It's a feel good factor. It's such a wonderful description of this barrier between the gut and the brain breaking down, and you came to really understand and know from yourself. So it's wonderful.
And I remember that moment so clearly. And it was so scary. Because I intellectually, the problem was, I could see both sides. I can see, there are really brainy people out there who remain priests because they see a theological, rational, in their view, reasoning, which makes sense to them. And I could see that. But I could also see the atheistic, non-believer part of me, which I would now kind of think of as my adult self, that doesn't need to believe in an imaginary friend and an afterlife which doesn't exist, other than the fact that my cells, my body will become something else when I die. That battle was always going on for 9 years.
It reminds me of The Hound of Heaven by Francis Thompson. Have you heard? Yeah, I'm sure you've
heard
it.
The title.
I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. It reminds me of that. The feeling, the pull to do and not wanting to go. You know, that feeling of fighting. I went through it myself when I was in the convent, of course, naturally. The priest would come to give you a retreat, and I would tell you to think about it. And naturally, you would think, am I being called? And this is why I was sent to college, Loretto, to be known. And I remember fighting with that, saying, I don't really want to be a nun, but maybe I should be.
How long were you in for?
Pardon?
How long were you a nun?
I was never a nun.
But you were in the convent?
I was at school.
Oh, at school. Oh, sorry. Okay.
I was a boarder in the school. So this is why when the priests had come to give retreats and that, they would ask you to think about it. And we did. But I rejected it.
But it's such a difference between people can be tormented with this recycling of trying to work things out all in the head. Mm. Whereas when you trust the wisdom of the body, you get the clear message.
But it sounded like I know I'm repeating myself a bit, but it was just so scary for me to make that choice. Am I seriously going to, resolve this being on the fence for 9 years? Am I going to jump on the basis of my gut? It was so scary. It was utterly scary, because all of those things, my identity and all those things, were all at stake. So risky. Why would you do it? And in your gut, right now, not tomorrow. And it was a breakthrough, and it was my Berlin Wall. And of course, Berlin Wall did come down in 1979. Yeah. It was the same year,
But that's what you said about being indoctrinated when you were a child. Mm. We were all, I don't know about Jill, but we were indoctrinated as children from the age of 4 up. And it was around us everywhere we could. It wasn't long afterwards. I must have been nearly 40 before it dawned on me there can't be a God, there can't be an afterlife. And but that's, and I'm wondering why that indoctrination is still going on in the schools today. And that's my one big book that I'm saying about. Now, I taught for 17 years, I taught infants. I indoctrinated children. Yeah. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa.
And that's a huge concern for me too, because when you've been indoctrinated and then you realise it's all bull, and I believed it, and look what, my 20s.
Yeah.
Now, okay, it's not a waste of time. I was asking good questions and I've come up with answers. It's not a waste of time, but it's still, it's happening again today. kids being initiated to believe in baloney.
Yeah.
And happily, a lot of them won't take it seriously, but some of them will. And they'll make life choices based on it. And like, I know nuns, priests, pastors who have spent their entire lives devoted to this imaginary God that doesn't exist. And then they get to a point in their life where they're too old, or they feel they're too old to chuck it in. Because what can they do now? Like, who'd have me now?
Yeah, you were telling me, you know, it took you 9 years when you're telling me about somebody, you know, who took 29 years before he left.
Yeah, and there are people who take even more, you know. Yeah. No, my good friend, a very good friend of mine, he was my best man at my wedding. And he took a little longer than me. But he's a great guy.
So, when you decided to use your journal entries to write a book, did you already know when you started that there might be two volumes or even more possibly?
And there we leave the first half of the Sligo event convened by Jill Bell, the Northwest Humanists. I shall upload the second half of that event, which focuses on the second book and what happened to me after I left my 9-year priestly path. Meanwhile, please do consider subscribing for free to Joe the Human Substack, and also indeed to subscribing to this podcast. Happy days!